What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And filling in for Adam Kempinar this week, I'm Trisha Bobita.
But why did you bring me here? Why did you take me?
Well, I had to take you. Because the first thing you'd be doing, you'd be scuttling around and yodeling the news that you were actually seeing a giant.
I promise you, Josh, there will be no scuttling or yodeling.
All right, Trisha, then I'll let you go back to the orphanage right after the show. Mark Rylance as Roald Dahl's big friendly giant with Ruby Barnhill Sophie in that clip from Steven Spielberg's highly anticipated adaptation of Dahl's The BFG. The Nerdette podcast, Trisha Bobita joins me for a review. We'll also share a top five children's book adaptations. That and more.
Scuttling, yodeling, fizz popping, whiz whirling.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including new $5 a month subscriber Heather from Lutz, Florida. Thank you, Heather, and to all of our monthly donors, we do appreciate your support. If you want to support the show but you can't spare the cash, well, how about rating us or leaving a review on iTunes? That really does make a difference. We want to thank AK-GESQ, CLR13, and Big Hack Daddy Aloha, as well as longtime listener Ben Flanagan from the Aspect Radio podcast for sharing reviews over the past couple of weeks. And just so there's no confusion, that's Big Hack Daddy Aloha with two A's. Filling in for Adam this week, Trisha Bobita, whom some of you may know as the co-host of WBEZ's Nerdette podcast. Trisha, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Feels a little ridiculous that this hasn't happened before.
Oh, I'm so excited about it because I've been listening for ages.
Yeah, excellent. Oh, yeah. And we, you know, it's silly because we record in the same building here at Navy Pier as you guys do for Nerdette. So really should have happened earlier. I guess the hours maybe have something to do with it. You work at WBEZ in another capacity as well. So you're here mostly during the day.
I'm here all the time, though. So really, anytime you wanted to record,
well,
I'm here nearly
24/7. We kind of skulk in pretty late sometimes, Adam and I, especially after screenings. Uh-huh. And it's awfully quiet around here. So I'm glad you did stick around extra, put in a longer day today so that you could join us for this week's show, the Nerdette podcast. Now, from what I can tell, and I've been listening since you guys have started pretty much, it's a show that allows you and your co-host, Greta Johnson, you just get to call people who you really admire and like and ask them about the things they love. Is that pretty much the gist of it?
That's basically it. Yeah, we use nerd as a verb. So it's not about what you love. It's about how much you love it. So we might talk to a movie nerd, but it could be a baseball nerd or a chemistry nerd. It's about an extreme level of passion that we find most interesting. And so talking to people who make stuff we love about the things that inspire them is just an endless source of conversations that we're excited to have and that people seem to enjoy listening to.
You even found a corgi nerd, a famous corgi nerd, right?
Stephen King, turns out. Master of horror, total softy when it comes to short-legged, big-eared dogs.
That was a great episode. Well, I have a few more questions for Trisha about Nerdette, including how Greta, your co-host, she claims to have seen only 10 movies in her life. We'll have to get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
We're going to save it all for later in the show. Also later, Trisha and I will do some nerding out of our own with our top five children's book adaptations. This is a perfect top five for Adam to miss as he's taking a week off because he always makes fun of me for wanting to and trying to read the book before I see the movie version as often as I can. But the funny thing is, I'm told if you listen to Adam's 2009 review of Where the Wild Things Are, this is before my time, that you can actually hear him state that he didn't catch up with Sundek's classic picture book, all 40 pages, you know, before seeing the film. And, you know, as a matter of fact, I know that as of this taping, he still hasn't read it, so he definitely needs to get to that. All right, first, Steven Spielberg made a pretty memorable movie about a kid who takes home a friendly alien, but how good is his movie about a friendly giant who takes home a kid?
It was the witching hour when the boogeyman comes out. When people go missing.
The girls say the witching hour arrives at midnight. I think it comes at 3 in the morning, when I'm the only one left awake. Like always, like now. Never get out of bed.
When it comes to beloved books that are turned into movies, there are two extreme philosophies, Tricia. Those who believe a movie owes nothing to its source material and should be considered independently of it, Adam. And those who believe that a movie's main responsibility is to be faithful to the page. I'm somewhere in between. I like to keep the source material in mind when watching a movie, but I also grant the filmmakers the opportunity to use it for their own means. What I find exciting are those moments I'll call inspired adaptation, when a movie takes a detail or a description from the book and envisions it in excitingly cinematic terms. I found a handful of moments like that in The BFG, Steven Spielberg's take on the Roald Dahl book about an orphan girl's close encounter with a big friendly giant. But before I share my favorite, I'm curious to hear if you experienced any moments like that in the film, Tricia, and maybe you can also talk about where you stand on the book-to-movie spectrum overall.
Sure. So I think you'll find in my top five list that I tried to bend the notion of adaptation even a little bit in that, because I think I would lean more towards the be inspired by the story and then make the best film you can.
Mm.
And so I thought actually that the BFG in some instances could have maybe benefited from moving a little more in that direction, because the adaptation felt almost too truthful at times to the book. But I loved the cinematic moment very early on in the film when we first see the giant slinking around London at night.
Mm.
And the ways he would hide very quickly. So I thought that that was something that, had you tried to describe it even as a masterful novel writer or children's book writer, it wouldn't have had the same effect as those instantaneous moments where he goes from walking down the street to being a tree and walking down the street to being a wall. And it was a fun montage of seeing how could this giant wander the streets and only be seen once in a while by a insomniac child.
Right. And you can feel the audience responding to those moments.
Oh, yeah.
In the screening we were at, right? There's kind of a little giggle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And each time he does it, it's a little bit different. He becomes something. He transforms. And so those were my favorite moments early on, where I realized, all right, not everything about this is going to be as I remember in the book. The scale is different. Because one of the things that stuck in my mind all these years later, having not reread the book, when you said the BFG, I said, oh, that's the book where the little kid sits in the giant's ear.
Yeah.
That was the first thing that popped into my head, was that image from the book. And so here we see that that's not the scale they went with, probably for very good reason when it came to making the movie. But it was something that was incredibly visual about this giant. It was all about scale, right? And a lot of fun was had with the difference in, you know, Sophie navigating the world of the giant and the giant navigating the world of people, where things were out of balance, and seeing how that all came to, you know, good or bad ends when they were trying to navigate physical spaces was often a lot of the jokes in the film. And a lot of the fun in the book is about that very big difference.
Sure, sure. And maybe the ear thing was a decision they made early on. That's one of those things that is more fun to imagine than see.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a little grody.
Maybe not even fun to imagine, but one of those doll touches where you're just like, ew, why is he putting that in there? I don't know if I like that. But to make it explicit on screen, it might lose some of that inspired ickiness that Dahl has in a lot of his writing. I loved the moment that I would say was inspired adaptation, and it uses shadows as well as those giant moments do when he's hiding and he's making himself into a shadow or hiding in a shadow. The one of the dream that is envisioned, the little boy's dream. And we should say, for those who aren't familiar with this story at all, that we learn that what the giant does with most of his time is collect dreams and collect nightmares. He quarantines the nightmares. This is often giant country. And then he will take the dreams and return to, in this case, England, and softly blow them into the bedrooms of sleeping children and give them nice dreams. So he's explaining this at one point, and we get to see it. And the boy's dream comes to life behind him. So the kid is sleeping in the foreground of the frame. And behind him, we see the dream being enacted as a shadow play. And it's just, I don't remember exactly how Dahl describes it. It might have been one of those passages where it's all caps written out. The giant will write a description of the dreams on the jars where he keeps them. I think it might be one of those. So it's pretty bare bones in the book, if that's the case. And here it just becomes this beautiful shadow play. And that's an instance where, again, like you said, the filmmakers are inspired by the book. They're using something from the book, but then saying, how can we make this a movie, you know, a really thrilling movie? And so that's maybe my favorite moment like that. But there are a lot of others, too, that I found. I think you might be onto something, though, in terms of it being too literal or faithful. Expand a little bit on what you mean about that, because I enjoyed this movie overall. Tons of stuff I liked about it, but I wasn't over the moon. There was something holding me back that I can't quite place my finger on in terms of why maybe this won't be one of my favorites of the year at the end of the year. And I can't identify it, but maybe it's related to its faithfulness.
I think, yeah, it was beautiful. It was lovely. I had a good time watching it. But there was something about the momentum of the story that felt lacking. At the end, when we find out that they are going to take on the giants and they realize whose help they need, a very important person whose help they need to make this happen, I think they could have done more throughout the way to let us know that these giants were hurting people. They kind of touched on it, and they made it clear that the giants were not nice to Runt, to our big friendly giant friend.
Right. These are other giants in giant country who are much bigger, angrier, and they do go off and eat people every night.
Their names are, you know, Meat Chomper and things like
this. Flesh Lump Eater. Yeah, wonderful doll names.
And so we know that they do this, but the urgency of needing to stop them, I felt like, could have been established better in the world that we're watching play out, because it seems like it was actually the bullying of the Runt, of our big friendly giant, that meant that they were going to do that. And they sort of left in the background this notion that, oh, by the way, these giants are eating children every night.
And the really horrible element of the book.
Yeah.
Maybe that's part of it. And, you know, they do play up the bullying aspect a little bit, I think. Not in terms of Sophie, the orphan, so much, but definitely in terms of the big friendly giant. And so maybe that's one modern type of angle that they try to emphasize. And I think it is a struggle in the adaptation that did hold me back. There's a section where they try to address how the giant speaks. And Sophie at first makes fun of him, and then he's embarrassed, and he uses, as we referred to at the top of the show, silly contortions of words and terms we're familiar with. So the most common one is he'll often say, is I left or is I right? Meaning, am I correct? And
right.
And there's a lot of fun like that on the page. And I was curious to see how far are they going to go with that? Like,
they really went for it.
They did. I think they transcribe it a little less than it is in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I do like how Mark Rylance, who provides the voice of the giant, and he was in Steven Spielberg's Bridge of Spies as the Russian spy, I do like how he plays that. But there's that moment maybe about three-fourths of the way in where he and Sophie have a conversation about it, and she sort of makes fun of him, and then he seems hurt, and then she backs off. That seems dropped in from the book.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it's in flow, like you're saying, with the narrative as we were experiencing it. I don't know if just leaving that out might have been better, but there's maybe a certain clunkiness in a faithfulness to the material that the movie does suffer from.
Those giants, they would swallow you up like a piece of frumpkin fry.
It's pumpkin pie, not frumpkin fry. And giraffes are giraffes. Crocodile dillies are crocodiles, and hippo dumplings are hippopotamuses.
I cannot be helping it if I'm saying things a little squiggly.
But again, Rylance, you know, in handling the language itself, what I like is that he almost puts more characterization into his sighs and his grumps than he does in these silly words. So he doesn't turn him into a clown. He turns this giant into a really lonely figure. And I think that echoes, of course, with the character of Sophie as well.
I love, too, that he is a reader when he gets the magnifying glass and wants to know what she's reading. And it's Nicholas Nickleby, right?
It is.
And, you know, this notion that people who are alone a lot, who are more readers than communicators verbally, end up having pronunciations for words that weren't correct.
Yes.
And end up living in their own little
about
world.
That.
I feel like that's come up recently for you guys a little bit. But I think that that's kind of a fun notion, too, that, you know, he reads these words and they get jumbled up in his head, but no one's there to correct him. And so he can feel self-conscious about it, but it's not like the giants are going to correct his grammar.
Right. Well, and they have even worse grammar than he does. So he's really well-educated in terms of the giants in giant country. I wanted to ask you in particular about the character of Sophie, because in terms of Spielberg films, and this definitely qualifies as one of his fantasies, if you want to break down the types of films he's made throughout his career, this is his first female protagonist, really. And I didn't know, it didn't really strike me that way until after the film. And I wonder if that's a detriment of the movie, that he doesn't make more of that, take more advantage of that, or is it something to admire about the movie that he's not forcing these gender types on his first female protagonist. You can kind of see it both ways. And it's interesting also, Sophie has a very sort of gender neutral look to her, and that plays into the costuming a little bit too.
Oh, absolutely. I kind of enjoyed that part of it, that it wasn't front and center in the character. It's a pre-adolescent girl. So she's got sort of this, you know, mop cut and
right.
the glasses and you know, spends a lot of the film in sort of, you know, this coat that belonged to a little boy beforehand. It has a sort of a military feel, a little red jacket.
She turns inside out.
Yep. She kind of makes it her own. And I think that I appreciated that there was a female protagonist where it wasn't about necessarily her having any notions of being a princess or any of these things that tend
yeah.
to fall into there being a character that age, where I think even, you know, in terms of being an orphan and being that age, the closest corollary for me would be Annie, right? And how much of Annie is about, you know, being a little girl
yes.
as opposed to just being a little kid. And so this, I thought, was refreshingly gender neutral. I think that it makes a character that any kid can put themselves in, as opposed to having to feel like, you know, any kid who's a little bookish, any kid who feels a little different, who likes the witching hour at 3 a.m., I was one of those kids. And so I liked that, you know, it wasn't a picture of a little girl that was completely, especially at the time, could have been much more traditional in some form
mm-hmm.
or fashion. There were certainly gender roles that would have been much stricter on her than even now. But instead, we got this sort of wild child.
Yeah. And well, and that's what that approach allows to happen, is her characteristics, independent of her gender, to be at the forefront. So the first thing we learn about Sophie is that, yes, she's up at the witching hour, the only one in the orphanage up, but also she's running the place, right? I like the little details, which I think are original from my memory, where she goes and collects the mail that's piled up during the day at the front door, because the woman running the orphanage, who we barely see, clearly isn't really taking care of these kids. Doesn't she even lock the door?
Yeah, she locks the door, kind of
nice
tidies
touch,
up for the night.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a sense of her providing security for all the other kids. And then, of course, in that very same opening sequence, the security is broken by the giant. Really a wonderful Spielberg sequence. When that hand comes through the window and the light streaming behind it, you know, it's the same light that's flying from E.T.'s spaceship, right?
Yeah.
I think they've got the same lamps. It just comes through and picks her up and gently carries her out. That was just magical. And another highlight of the film to me is that's one of those things where you envision in your head reading the book and you just hope they don't screw it up,
yeah.
A. And then B, if they can really capture it the way you imagined it, it's even more exciting. But this kind of brings us to the realm of the special effects, which I think we should spend some time on, because there's a lot involved here, a lot of CGI, and especially it flirts with what everyone terms the uncanny valley, you know, this depiction of human features where maybe our technology isn't quite there yet. And so it's realistic, but also eerie because it's not all the way there.
The classic example being the Polar Express, right? Where
yes.
we were all just a little creeped out by the Tom
yes.
Hanks animation in that movie.
Exactly. So would you say your experience of the BFG in particular, it's his face we see mostly, he's the most human. Even these other bigger giants are more monstrous.
Yeah.
So we give that a little more leeway, or at least I did, but the BFG is much more human, and we see his face and his expressions. Was he a little too Polar Express for you, or did you buy it?
I bought it. I thought it worked. I think the scale differential made it less odd than in Polar Express. It was just, you know, human people all the whole time, and
okay.
so it was a little stranger, because he is, you know, the giant ears, and the whole thing
mm-hmm.
was kind of fun. And I thought that the moments where you see the warmth in his face, I felt that as warmth and not uncanny
okay.
creepiness.
Yep.
And so I felt like it worked for me. I was watching out for that too, because, I mean, this is really a movie where it's mostly a talented child in a green room, if we went back to see
yes.
how it was filmed, right?
Which made me think of The Jungle Book, where
yeah.
I learned afterwards it was this little kid just with a lot of times really fake-looking puppets around him he had to act with. So I haven't had a chance to look yet how they did this, but I'm assuming it's something similar.
Yeah, especially when you think about, you know, the parts in the giant's cave and seeing the two of them. And again, whenever the two of them have to interact in the same space, I would be curious to know which version of the set was built, if any.
Mm.
If, you know, if Sophie was running down a corridor in the giant's cave, was there something real to that and the giant was then superimposed in? Or was there a set that was the cave and then they were sort of shrinking her down, for lack of a better way
right,
of explaining
right.
it? You know, who got to work in a real setting? Because it feels like most of the film would have been her hanging on to something when she's riding around on the giant shoulder. There's just her in a green room having to do a lot of work on her own as an actor.
And I think she's pretty convincing in that regard. She's somewhere maybe in between the really annoying child actor you could get and the brilliantly naturalistic one where you're like, wow, they don't even seem to know they're acting. I'd place this performance by Ruby Barnhill somewhere in between.
I think so, yeah. I mean, in terms of the writing of the film, again, they could have given her more to say maybe in some of these scenes. There was a lot of her just shouting, BFG!
Yeah.
BFG!
That's pretty good. That's really good.
And then just elongating the G a little longer each time. Let's do like one more that's even longer. BFG! Like there was, I mean, about, you know, maybe
that's
20% of the dialogue
in the
film.
That's where I started to get a little annoyed. Yeah. The third one you did is where I was kind of like, okay, back up a little bit.
But that's what she got to work with, right?
Right. Yeah, you can't blame her too much, I guess. I think in those relationship scenes and the scenes in the cave as well, they did enough but maybe could have done more with the whimsical sense of scale and the use of other objects where you're like, oh, he sleeps in an actual large ship.
Yeah, the pirate ship bed was fun.
That's really cool. But they don't do too much of that. And I'm thinking a movie spoiler that'll come up in our top five, something like The Secret World of Arrietty based on The Borrowers. And it was all about these miniature people.
Yeah.
And every detail you're like, oh, look at cool. Look at how they use that spoon or look at how they use this. There's some of that here, but maybe not as much as I felt like they could have done.
Yeah, and I think the giant's cave, I could have used a little more time passing in that relationship building there, because we went pretty quickly from her showing up and going, who are you? What is this monster that took me from my bed? Giant hand that took me from my bed. She very quickly trusts him and is fine there and wants to stay with him. And I get that she's an orphan and that this seems like a more magical and fun place to be than a terrible orphanage that she was in. But it also felt like she was too quickly eager to stay and eager to be with him. I could have used, I don't know, maybe even a montage of watching some of those kind of fun things happen where you figured out how they were a team, you know, things that they could do together because he was big and she was small. And, you know, that might have been cheesy and maybe it's not a good idea, but it felt like not enough time passed or that the relationship built before suddenly they were sort of going all out to save each other from the other giants and just a natural team. There was no time that passed.
So do you think some of that relationship building might have given this movie a bit more emotional impact for you? Because when I think about it in terms of Spielberg's work, and I don't know how big of an aficionado you are, how many of his films you've seen, maybe that's holding me back a little bit too, is there wasn't quite that wallop. I mean, he's accused of being a sentimentalist by a lot of people, and some consider that a weakness for him. And this almost oddly, as a children's book adaptation, for me at least, was a little reserved in terms of sentimentality. And I think the idea was there, because if you put this in the context of his other fantasies, these close encounters, a lot of times it struck me that what's distinctive about them is where the encounters lead the characters, okay? And I'd include Jaws as a fantasy, and that leads to death, his first one. But then you get something like, you know, E.T., I think, leads to a certain enlightenment, and Close Encounters, you know, definitely leads to something, this mystical possibility. The BFG leads to this encounter between Sophie and the giant, leads to something kind of minor. I'd almost say domestic tranquility. It's sort of a quaint place that we go to. And I'm trying to figure out for myself, is that admirable? Is that something like, oh, Spielberg didn't push it too hard. It's just he's bringing us to, there's the early touch of Sophie looking at a dollhouse, right? In the orphanage. And she looks at the room that's a bedroom. And you can see she's thinking, boy, I'd like to sleep there rather in this room with 30 beds all lined up in a hall. Lovely touch later, right? When there's this tree stump in his cave and it's been formed into a tiny bedroom and he places her in that. And I love that callback. You know, that's about as far as Spielberg pushes it in terms of emotional effect. But maybe that's why I'm left a little cold by the movie too.
And I guess maybe he thought we would come along for the notion that, of course, an orphan wants a family. But at the end, these emotional moments where the friend aide of some sort, this young woman who's in some way employed by the queen, seems to have adopted her and kisses her on the forehead in a very motherly way. But we saw them interact for a hot second in this film.
You're a little bit like, back off.
Yeah, it was a little
I don't know that you have this right yet.
Yeah, and so, you know, we see that she's gotten a family out of this deal, a la Annie, right? The orphan gets to live in the palace.
Sure.
But we didn't see her yearning for that specifically. We can imply, because she's an orphan, that she wanted that. And we didn't see that relationship. We didn't see that character along the way wanting a family either, right? Part of the heart of Annie is that you see that this woman wants to nurture, and then she gets Annie, and there's a family that's formed. We had no attachment to the character who became her mother, so there was a one-sided emotion, if any. And yet, again, right. Like you said, why are you kissing this kid on the head? You just met him.
Yeah, yeah. I felt that a little bit in that scene as well. So it sounds like recommendations, but with a few reservations for the BFG on both our parts.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely the scenes where they're dream catching and all those things are beautiful and fun to watch. And especially if you're going to take a kid who just read this book to see it, I think that they're going to love it. And, you know, seeing it on the big screen is fun. But in terms of the story and, you know, seeing the screenplay on the page and how it transformed, maybe not all the right pieces in all the right order there.
The BFG is out in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree, let us know. feedback@filmspotting.net. Will the BFG be considered one of the best films of 2016 so far? You get a chance to say in the Film Spotting poll, asking about the year's top movies at the midway point. That's next, along with the results of our Fantastic Mr. Fox, Where the Wild Things Are Deathmatch. Stay with us.
A place she doesn't recognize, standing by the staircase, she follows their eyes. Always wore the same perfume, but they no longer notice when she enters the room. There was a time when she was the most beautiful girl in the
you to help me get home. Okay, buddy?
Okay, buddy.
Daniel Radcliffe and Paul Dano in just a bit of the trailer for Swiss Army Man, or the Farting Corpse movie. I think I'm contractually obliged to refer to it in that way. Do you know anything about this film, Tricia, or are you being horrified at this moment?
I've seen Daniel Radcliffe get interviewed about this film, okay. And so I've seen him talk about it a little bit, and basically both apologize and be excited about the fact that it is, in fact, the Farting Corpse movie.
Okay.
But I've been told that it has heart as well as farting.
I've seen, I think they go hand in hand, don't they? I mean, no, I've seen some early reviews coming out that are positive. Although at the Sundance Film Festival, which is where people first got a chance to see it, there were some walkouts, too. So a divisive movie, perhaps we can say. It does open in limited release this weekend. It's also the film that Adam and guest host Melissa Taminga are planning to review on next week's show. A few notes here before we get to the polls for this week. We have free passes still for Wiener Dog. We've been mentioning this for a few weeks now. It's Todd Solondz' latest. It's sort of an Alhazard Wiener Dog. It follows the wayward adventures of a dachshund who passes from one oddball owner to another. And it's loosely connected to Solondz' Welcome to the Dollhouse. It's going to open in Chicago, at least, on Friday, July 15. And we have an admit-to-pass to an advanced screen on Thursday, July 7. That's going to be at the Landmark Century Center Cinema. So visit filmspotting.net and you can find out the details on how to enter for that. I have a correction to make. It's a good thing I'm here this week instead of Adam, because this is my fault in our review last week of the documentary De Palma. I said that it was Jake Kasdan rather than Jake Paltrow who directed De Palma alongside Noah Baumbach. So it is indeed Jake Paltrow, who is the co-director. There I mixed up the two Jakes on episode 591. Also wanted to quickly mention that I had a chance to be on Christopher Harris's new podcast, The Juggernaut. Listeners probably recognize Christopher's name because we've had him on Film Spotting. I think it was a few years ago now, to talk about one of his books, one of his novels, and we also talked about film noir on that episode. Christopher's best known as a fantasy football expert, was at ESPN for a number of years, now runs his own podcast, Harris Football, but he's also launched The Juggernaut, and this is where he talks with writers, musicians, critics, and about creative work. His next book, War on Sound, is a novel about a rock band, so he gets a chance to talk with others who are working in that arena. I was able to talk about my forthcoming book, which now has an official title, I want to say, and a release date. I've mentioned this a few times on the show in the last year or so, but it's getting more official. The title is Movies Are Prayers, How Films Voice Our Deepest Longings. And the release date, they tell me, is spring 17. I've got a first draft in. I'm waiting to hear back about how much revision I'm going to have to do. I'm sure there's some involved, but I'm looking forward to that. My editor at InterVarsity Press, Helen Lee, has given me a ton of great ideas so far, and so I look forward to diving back into that soon and getting it out by the spring of 2017. All right, that ends the apologies and self-promotion part of the show. Anything you want to apologize for or promote, Tricia, before we move on?
Oh, geez. I would say that if you're about to binge watch and catch up on Game of Thrones, that maybe you could listen to the Nerd Out Recaps Game of Thrones that we do with Peter Sagal.
Yes.
So if you've been stocking up on episodes to watch for the rest of the summer or you're a little bit behind, we, after every episode that came out this season, sat down with Peter on Monday mornings and hashed it out, talked about every twist and turn in the Seven Kingdoms. So anyone who's a fan of those books and that show, I would say, you know, come hang out with us and listen to the podcast. We have an awful lot of fun doing that.
You guys do have fun, so much so that I haven't jumped into Game of Thrones yet, but I listened to your previous episode with Peter, and yeah, it was fun to listen to you guys get into that. Okay, let's get into the polls for this week. A couple of weeks back, in anticipation of this week's top five, we gave listeners this children's book adaptation, Deathmatch, Class of 09 edition, Wes Anderson's Roald Dahl adaptation, Fantastic Mr. Fox, versus Where the Wild Things Are, Spike Jonze's adaptation of the Maurice Sendak classic. Tricia, how did it come out?
In the best children's book adaptation of 2009, Where the Wild Things Are came in at 35%, which means that the Fantastic Mr. Fox won in a landslide with 65%.
And Mr. Fox had it early on, pretty much ran with it. We didn't get much of a challenge from Where the Wild Things Are, even though that's where I voted and Adam did as well. Jason Wilson from Toronto, he says, I voted for Fantastic Mr. Fox, but I wish I could change it. No, not to Where the Wild Things Are. That movie suffers from bloat due to expanding the scope of the kids' book in order to reach feature length. No, assuming it's all relegated to 2009, there's still a superior other option, and that's Henry Selick's beautiful, funny, haunting, and singular argument in favor of 3D, the adaptation of Neil Gaiman's Coraline. It's a perfectly economical film that gives just enough development and backstory while also immersing you in the weirdness of the alt world. The animation is charming and appropriately creepy in places. It's basically training wheels for future horror fans. There's amazing voice work from everyone in the cast. You've got the king of voice acting in Keith David, plus the likes of Terry Hatcher, John Hodgman, and Ian McShane. But it's Dakota Fanning as Coraline who imbues the film with a sense of urgency, realism, and stakes. Coraline is my favorite children's book adaptation, and I'd even say it does what neither of the official options does, and that's improve on the source material. Well, Jason, I can't go quite as far as you, but I did have Coraline at number 5 on my best films of 2009 list. I had Where the Wild Things Are number 1, Mr. Fox number 3, and Coraline number 5. So I wasn't ashamed to put three children's book adaptations on that list. Are you familiar with Coraline, Tricia?
Oh, yeah. Great film. And I love Neil Gaiman. One of my very favorite episodes of Doctor Who ever was directed by him. And his books are, I think, some of the best fodder for adaptation. I think they're doing an American Gods TV show soon, which is based on his novel, so that'll be exciting. Anything Neil Gaiman, I think, is always good.
And I'd agree with Jason on the 3D, too. That's Coraline is one of those movies that I point to that actually makes use of 3D, integral to the form of cinema that's going on there. It's one of the few, one of the few.
Well, Michael Murphy in New Jersey says that the Battle of 09 could have been opened up with Coraline for sure, and also Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, our introduction to the consistently surprising minds of Phil Lord and Chris Miller of the Lego Movie. I think those would have been four very formidable, qualified, and interesting opponents. Limiting to Jones and Anderson does make for an enticing deathmatch, however, and given that, I have to go with Fox. Jones' Wild Things never caught on with me, which is sad because I adore Sendak's book. I admire the defenders, but something about it never coalesced, and it could be because it's such an auteuristically rendered vision of the book that, despite my love for Jones' other work, I couldn't get past how he evolved and adapted the source material. Fantastic Mr. Fox, on the other hand, is an absolute gem. Anderson's style, the pitch-perfect voice casting, that sense of humor, and the sheer beauty of the stop motion. It's one of my favorite Andersons, top three for sure. I think it could stand on its own against any number of animated films, from its stop-motion brethren at Aardman to the champions of the medium at Pixar.
Currently my number 2 Wes Anderson film, Michael, and case you're wondering. Dan Wessler wrote in and said, as not only my choice out of these two, but also my favorite film of 2009, I have to go with Where the Wild Things Are. I definitely have love for Fantastic Mr. Fox, and it may be a more faithful adaptation of its source material, but when I look at the movies themselves, Jones's film comes out on top. I'm 31 years old, and Wild Things made me feel feelings that I haven't felt since I was 9. Using a very simple picture book as source material, Jones created a piece of art that evokes every emotion of a child. What makes you angry? What makes you giddy? What makes you act out and immediately regret your actions? And just in general, the emotional roller coaster that is childhood. It's certainly not a kid's movie. The melancholy that permeates around and through its carefree joyfulness has a complexity that can only be appreciated by people who have been through that phase of life and moved on. Long story short, Fantastic Mr. Fox is charming. Where the Wild Things Are is transcendent. Tricia, we haven't heard your vote. Have you seen both of these films? And if so, this is usually how we think about these death matches. The one you don't vote for gets erased. It's gone.
Oh, so, that is harsh. So that's true.
It's, if you love both of these, it's going to make it a little bit harder. Have you seen them both?
I have seen them both. I have to make sure that Where the Wild Things Are, it continues to exist in that paradigm. I think whoever it was that said that it was more transcendent, I felt that way about the film. And I think if we talk about the source material, I'm just closer to the Sendak book than I am the other. So that's part of it for me, too. It's just the joy of seeing that brought to life was one that the Fantastic Mr. Fox was very enjoyable. Great movie. But Where the Wild Things Are, I had been waiting ages for somebody to make that movie.
And it lived up to it.
It did.
That was my experience as well. All right. That brings us to our new poll. We are bringing June to a close this week. We're marking the halfway point of the year. That's as good a reason as any to do some arbitrary ranking of films. Tricia, we're going to try to decide, at least have Film Spotting Nation decide, what is the best film of the year so far. Here are the choices we're giving listeners.
Captain America, Winter Soldier, Everybody Wants Some, Hail Caesar, The Lobster, The Witch, and Other.
Yes, we try to include Other. And I'm noticing here that our co-producer, Sam Van Halgren, put double exclamation points after every title, inspired obviously by Everybody Wants Some. But that really does kind of make each film much more exciting, doesn't it, when you see that afterwards?
Especially The Witch. It makes it seem like she's right behind
she's
you.
She's coming for you. Yes. Well, we did include Other as well because we know that your favorite may not be represented on this list. So go ahead, click Other, and then let us know what that other film is. We always want to hear from those who are voting in our poll. Tricia, do you have a favorite of the year so far? And if so, is it represented here on this list?
I loved Hail Caesar. I'm a big fan of those movies that it's sort of paying homage to. And so for me, it was fun to see that come to life. I thought George Clooney was great. I thought there were some performances of folks who I hadn't seen in a lot of other things that I thought really stood out. So of that list, I would say that Hail Caesar was my favorite.
I like your thinking. Right now, Hail Caesar is battling with The Lobster for the number one slot for me for this year in terms of top movies of the year so far. Adam and I are going to share our top five of the year so far in a couple of weeks, so I'll have to decide by then. You can vote now in this poll and let us know what your favorite film of 2016 is so far at filmspotting.net. As we said, please leave a comment, and if you leave a comment, also let us know where you're listening from.
Well, my husband and I watch it as self-care, like as therapy. It's like the only thing that brings my blood pressure down because it's so Columbo always fixes it. So even like once in a while he lets the murderer go if he realizes that, you know, if he realizes that they were just in a bad situation. That's really rare.
It's the best. You're right.
It's, wow.
I'm co-signing this homework.
You guys, I've never seen it.
Oh my gosh, we're gonna watch Columbo.
Okay.
So as we mentioned at the top, Tricia, Nerdette is pretty much a chance for you, a guest, in this case, writer Lindy West, who we heard there, to nerd out about one of your favorite things together. In this case, it was Columbo. But your co-host, Greta Johnson, admitted that she had never seen Columbo. I don't know how that's possible. But from being a listener of the show, I also realized that Greta has not seen a lot of movies either. So I guess in her case, it is possible.
She watches plenty of TV, though.
She watches a lot of TV.
I'm not sure what her excuse is here.
Well, yeah, that's true. And we should say she's also a huge reader, so she's got that covered. And from what I understand from talking to her recently at a WBEZ event, she's delving into Marvel, the Marvel Cinematic Universe lately. So I don't know if you guys are planning to get into that on the show anytime soon. You know, Marvel really needs more coverage.
I think
you should get on that. I really like that interview with Lindy West, though. She's the cultural critic and author of the memoir Shrill. And there was one piece from that book that you guys highlighted that struck me as well, where she said, in a certain light, feminism is just realizing the things you love actually hate you.
Yeah.
And there was something that kind of like, oh, that hits you hard when you hear someone say that. And to have you and Greta talk about having a similar experience, I'm wondering what movies you maybe can recall having that experience with, maybe growing up or maybe recently?
Growing up especially, I think that so much of the sort of most poppy romantic comedy films really play into this idea that you're just a good eyebrow tweeze and contact lens away from finding love.
The makeover.
The makeover movies where, you know, you're invisible to the world until you put a lot of time and energy, and let's be real, money. This is about capitalism. It's about selling women on products to make themselves look like these people in these movies. And to realize that things like The Princess Diaries or Bridget Jones Diary, all these films that feel sort of fun and you know, that you could watch, you know, at a sleepover when you're 12, 13 years old and think like, this is what being an adult woman is like. Obviously, you know that it's not real, but it's setting up this idea that by 30, every one of us is going to be a magazine editor with perfect bangs.
And great apartments.
And great,
right?
Huge New York apartments. And so I think that when you realize that those movies are selling you on an idea of something, and that is a very specific idea of what it means to be successful and what it means to be beautiful. And then on the flip side of that, that's if you get any female representation in films at all.
Yeah.
So many of my favorite movies and favorite movie protagonists are all men.
Yeah.
Or coming of age.
Well, and that's where the tension is, right?
Yeah.
Because these are things that you do appreciate and have an attachment to for other reasons, yet have to hold at the same time that they're operating in this very demeaning way.
I mean, knowing that the Bechdel test is failed by a movie doesn't mean that I'm not going to watch it, doesn't mean I'm not going to love it. But
yeah,
as an adult who's gone to gender studies classes in college, I have to see it through that lens. And I think we should. I don't think it should stop us from enjoying things. I don't think you should only watch movies that you deem feminist, because what does that even mean?
Right.
But there's an idea that feminism is trying to be co-opted as a more mainstream notion. And I think it's important for us to remember that feminism has to be for everybody. It can't just be something that you buy on a t-shirt.
Okay.
Which is, I think, Lindy's idea too. And,
yeah,
and many others who are in the space right now, is that it's important to see female anti-heroes. It's important to see, and I think we're seeing that a little more now, especially in TV. So, you know, Lena Dunham on Girls gets a lot of guff for the portrayal of that character. But I think it's exciting that there's a character that's a young woman who we're kind of supposed to not like.
Mm.
That's exciting to me, that we're branching out enough that we're getting characters like that, and that Mindy Kaling is doing things in her work and others are doing things in pop culture that make it a little more complex to be a female protagonist or anti-hero.
Just more human, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the makeover comment also makes me think you might be on my side. Adam and I got into a debate about The Breakfast Club. We did a Sacred Cow review of this. I don't know how well you remember the film, but we revisited it. I think it was this year. And a little bit of a debate about the meaning of the makeover scene there. I had some issues with it, but Adam's opinion was that it wasn't quite operating. There were other things going on than your more generic makeup scene. So I don't know. Next time you watch Breakfast Club, let me know where you fall on that one, maybe. How about the opposite of this experience you're talking about, where something that you love, you're starting to realize, oh, it's not, doesn't really have me in mind at all, even though I love it. Were there movies, and maybe these are few and far between, and that's part of the problem, but can you recall experiences, again, either when you were younger or more recently, where you said, okay, I love this thing and it loves me. It gets me.
I think one of the first times I felt that was with the film Mean Girls.
Yes.
Because it played into everything that was what we were just talking about. It's about young, pretty people by Hollywood standards and all this, but it's so self-aware and it's so funny. And I felt like Tina Fey gets me. You know, I always have and always will feel a little bit like Liz Lemon. And so that's not the main character in that film, obviously, but all the tangential characters and the self-referential ways that they play with the idea of sort of the teen comedy, I just love. That was the first movie where I felt like it worked in the genre and also as a commentary on the genre at the same time in a really fun way.
Okay, so we're all here because of this book, right? Well, I don't know who wrote this book, but you all have got to stop calling each other sluts and whores. It just makes it okay for guys to call you sluts and whores. Who here has ever been called a slut? Okay, everybody up.
Miss Norbury had us write out apologies to people that we'd hurt in our lives.
Alyssa, I'm sorry I called you a gap-toothed bitch. It's not your fault you're so gap-toothed.
The great thing about Mean Girls to me is I absolutely loved it when it first came out. but it's lived on. You know, I didn't know if it would be one of those comedies that, and I find myself having this experience with comedies a lot, that I loved and everyone else just kind of forgets. But I hear that come up all the time. And by, I don't know what year it came out actually offhand, but I feel like there's been enough time where there's another generation that's starting to discover it anew and it's resonating with them in the same way. So that's encouraging to see that a movie that has that much good stuff going on is really still having an influence or striking a chord, I guess, with audiences in the way that it did for you.
The limit does not exist to what that film will do for us.
Yes,
that's the reference you must make at that moment, is the limit does not exist.
So, Nerdette, you guys are going to go on a bit of a summer break.
Yeah, we're taking
right?
just a few weeks off between seasons to ramp up our next season. So we'll be back at the end of July, I think it is. And, you know, we've got some live events coming up and some other things that are going to help us fill the summer. But we're already putting together some interviews and some episodes for the next season. And we're excited about those for sure.
So what that means, and you guys regularly talk about doing homework on the show, right? Fun homework assignments that come out of the show that listeners should jump in and take care of in between shows. For Film Spotting listeners, that gives them a chance, if they aren't already listening, to catch up on your archives. So we're definitely going to link to Nerdette in the show notes. You'll be able to find that at filmspotting.net.
That knows how to use them. They're no use to you. Give them back to me. Give them back.
Keep tight inside of them. Their magic must be very powerful, or she wouldn't want them so badly.
You stay out of this, Glinda, or I'll fix you as well.
Oh, rubbish. You have no power here. Be gone before somebody drops a house on you too.
The Wizard of Oz, the single film in the Film Spotting pantheon that qualifies for this week's top five children's book adaptations, unless I guess you're the kind of parent whose bedtime reading to your kids extends to, say, Jake LaMotta's Raging Bull My Story or Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Those were adapted into other films that are in the pantheon, that list of movies that are so beloved by us that we'd mention them all the time on top five lists if we could. So we set those aside. Wizard of Oz, not eligible, even though it would have probably made my list. A couple of other restrictions that I put on myself, at least when I was thinking about this, Tricia. I wanted these movies to be made from books that had cultural relevance as books first, okay? So if you think of something like Bambi or maybe Pinocchio, I at least, and I don't think the culture at large thinks of those anymore as books. I think they think of them as Disney movies, right?
Sure.
So there are maybe a couple of titles that technically could have applied, but because of that, I didn't consider them for my list. I also had to consult the experts at home because I live with a children's librarian, my wife, Debbie, who you met recently, does this for a living. And my daughters are bigger readers than they are movie lovers, though they do like films. So I had asked them, you know, if you were making this list, what would be at the top? Now, they, as you might expect, and to Adam's horror, consider fidelity to the source material to be very important. That's, you know, the top priority
readers,
for them.
Those
yeah,
readers.
I know, pesky readers. So when I asked them, actually, Debbie's choice was Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And she just said, you know, that's the one that was not only true to the book, but also the perfect casting, the production design, all of that stuff was exactly how she imagined it. So a little bit maybe what we were talking about in terms of Where the Wild Things Are, though that one goes far afield from the source material, it still gets, at least for you, it sounded like, and it did for me, how I imagine that world to be or to feel, it gets that. So I think for Debbie, That is what Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone did. Did you have criteria, Tricia, similar to that? Or how did you think about forming your list?
So I wanted to keep the books as children's books. So that meant I was trying to avoid any of the YA trilogy territory.
Good point. Yeah,
and
we decided
to
do that.
To be, you know, maybe fourth or fifth grade reading level and younger books to start. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that put Harry Potter right at the cusp and some other things right at the cusp. So I tried to veer more towards the stories that I remember being, you know, the kind of children's books that I think of as big hardcover books with a lot of illustrations. And so if I had a memory of a book like that and a movie like that, I tried to piece those two things together and think, okay, yeah, these are both important to me as books and important to me as movies. And then I had to play with the rules a little bit for one of the items on my list because I just like the movie too much to have not put it on there.
Okay. Well, as a guest host, you have a little more leeway. So we'll allow that.
All right,
yes.
All right.
Yes. Well, but after this, you really got to get it together. Let's get into it then. What do you have as your number five children's book adaptation?
So this is my one with the asterisk on
okay.
it, because technically Peter Pan is a play first, but it gets turned into a children's book so often, right? There was a beautiful illustrated copy of Peter Pan that I read and that I had read to me. So I decided that I was going to sneak it onto my list, even though it's a play. And then I was going to even spin it a little bit out farther and say that it's not the Peter Pan animated film or any of the Pan films that come out that are on my list, but Steven Spielberg's Hook.
Ooh, this might be the real problem. So a Hook fan we have, huh?
This movie came out when I was at the exact perfect age for it.
That would have been?
So it came out in 1991, and I was born in 87.
Okay.
So when this movie came out, it was maybe one of the first movies I saw at a movie theater.
Yeah, okay.
And so the big screen nature of The Lost Boys and the world that they create in that film, I've gone back and watched it since, and it feels like it's a movie that was meant to create a theme park ride down the line. But it was also my introduction to actors like Robin Williams and Dustin Hoffman. I watched films later on. I remember being in middle school and kind of getting into films, you know, like capital F films, and watching some of Dustin Hoffman's movies and going like, that's Captain Hook.
It's Hook. Where's his wig?
Where's his excellent wig? And in Tootsie, he had another excellent wig.
It's true.
But so, you know, it really played with the idea of adaptation to me. It was not just the source material, but let's take one step further with this story. What happens next?
Sure.
That was something that was a thought experiment I like to do often as a kid, is what would happen in the sequel before there was one. And so for me, Hook did that, a thing that I had always wondered about. What would happen if Peter Pan grew up? It's got Maggie Smith in it.
Yeah.
It's got all these actors in it who I grew to love for so many other reasons later on. So going back and watching it is a nostalgic thing more than a like that this is an excellent film. It's more that it puts me back to being a little kid watching a movie on the big screen for maybe one of the first times I can remember.
You are a fart factory. Slug slimed sack of rat guts and cat vomit. Cheesy scab picked pimple squeezing finger bandage. A week old maggot burger with everything on it and flies on the side.
Yeah! Substitute chemistry teacher.
Come on, Rufio, hit a mat. Mung tongue.
Math tutor?
Pinhead.
Prison barber.
Mother lover.
Nearsighted gynecologist.
In your face, camel cake!
In your rear, cow derriere.
Lying, crying, spying, prying, ultra pig!
You lewd, crude, rude, bag of pre-chewed food dude.
Majorette Peter!
I wonder if that's distinctive, that as a kid you were open to taking source material that far, because generally when I talk to kids, it's like my kids said, fidelity is what they want to see. So for you to have that sort of open vision, I can see why Hook then would resonate with you. And I know the movie has its defenders. It's been a while since I've watched it too. It makes me think that one of the things I do like about the BFG is that the volume level, you could say they're both dealing with similar material in a way, children's book play adaptations. Mm-hmm. We'll allow that, Tricia. But I think the volume level in the BFG is lower, particularly when it comes to the comedy. There's sort of an extended sequence where we didn't spoil it, but where Sophie and the BFG meet this authority figure and ask her for help. And that's really a long comedy sequence with some pretty broad humor in it.
Yeah.
But it isn't quite as brash or loud as some of the parts in Hook that I remember. So Hook, though, is one that I would like to revisit. And I was going to try to squeeze it in, actually, when you had mentioned earlier you were thinking about putting it on your list, but we didn't quite get to it. I did get to a movie that I had never seen before in preparation for this list, and it made it onto the list as my number five. It's another Roald Dahl adaptation. It is The Witches.
Yeah.
So I don't usually worry about things like ratings, you know, the MPAA and why they gave this an R or they gave this a PG. But I have to wonder, I mean, were they insane to give this a PG? I mean, this is one case where I have to wonder. This is 1990. Okay, so it's long after the Spielberg Temple of Doom debacle, which was part of the whole reasoning behind getting a PG-13 category. Yet somehow, even though this came out afterwards, and despite having Angelica Houston, right, peeling her face off to reveal possibly the most horrifying witch visage I've ever seen, it still got a PG. I don't know how that happened. I made a few notes about this on Letterboxd after watching it, and Ethan wrote there in response, excellent indeed, but I remember as a child being traumatized by all of the body horror.
And
there is a lot of body horror in this thing, not something you get in a lot of children's films. Now, like Dahl's work, I think this does a good job, and the body horror speaks to this, of not catering to children's more delicate sensibilities. Think about that really creepy opening prologue where the grandmother is telling the main character a story about this little girl who disappears from her village, and she ends up appearing in her father's favorite painting and ends up like aging in the painting over decades. I mean, I'm watching this as an adult, like just kind of withering and, and feeling creeped out. And then the main storyline, of course, involves witches plotting to mass murder the children of England. Okay. You know, light stuff for a kid's film, right? You also have Houston, who I love that she's having a grand time with the comedy and is very funny, but she's not so comic that she forgets to be scary. She manages to capture both of those elements.
One child a week is no good to me.
We will do better. We will do much better.
Better is no good either. I demand maximum results. So, here are my orders. My orders are that every child in England shall be rubbed out, destroyed.
The director here is Nicholas Rogue, and he does a lot with the camera, particularly after the young hero, who's played by Jason Fisher, gets turned into a mouse. The movie, for the second half, it almost becomes a number of like Ratatouille-style adventures, and Rogue employs these extremely low angles. There are some grotesque close-ups, some mice-eye view shots that are kind of neat, and all of that just enhances the unsettling surrealism. So, you know, having watched it for the first time as an adult, I was kind of glad I didn't see it as a kid. Is that the age you first saw it, though?
Oh, yeah. I was terrified of that movie. I saw that movie at an age when it definitely gave me nightmares. I mean, both made me afraid of rats and mice and, you know, Angelica Houston forever. I was going to be terrified of both of those things evermore after seeing that film. But it was fantastic. And yeah, just really did not go like, oh, boo, kind of violence that happens in some kids' movies. It was scary. You thought that they were going to...
There's a threat, like an insidious threat throughout. Yeah,
scary in a way that I'm not sure many kids' movies are now.
No, probably not. But I'm glad to hear you survived and are relatively unscarred by it. What did you have as your number four children's book adaptation?
So this is one that I remember watching on VHS a lot over and over as a kid, and that's the 1967 musical version of Dr. Dolittle, not to be confused with the later, late 90s Eddie Murphy version of this, but the version
going with the original.
Going with the original that starred Rex Harrison and Anthony Newley, who's one of my favorite performers. You know, these were big Broadway stars who then did this movie. And it was funny because I remember as soon as you said top five list with children's book adaptations, I thought Dr. Dolittle. And then when I went back to realize what the arc of that story is, it's insane. It's the strangest movie. There are characters in this movie and animals that aren't real. He talks to animals. He's a veterinarian. And then they go off on this journey to look for a pink snail. I mean,
Sounding a little psychedelic.
It's a little psychedelic, which as a kid you don't necessarily get. But then you go back and watch it as an adult and you're like, oh, these people had taken some substances to help them write this film, I think, perhaps, because it is wild. But it has these big, beautiful musical numbers in it. And it has, you know, the I Want songs that you love if you love musical theater.
I conferred with our furry friends, man to animal. Think of the amazing repartee. If I could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with the animals, and they could talk to me.
And so it had a lot of the things that I love from those big MGM style movie musicals of the 60s and 70s that I grew up watching a lot of as a kid. And so this was one that stuck out to me as Rex Harrison and Anthony Newley just being fantastic in this film.
Okay. Have not seen either of those, but I think I'll start with the original and then make my way up to the Eddie Murphy one. Might be the wiser way to go. My number four is a movie that I mentioned in our BFG review, and it's The Secret World of Arrietty. There's some cross-cultural adaptation going on here. The director is Hiromasa Yonabayashi, and along with the help of screenwriter and producer Hayao Miyazaki, he made this 2012 variation of the Mary Norton British children's novel, The Borrowers. It's about a family of little people who live beneath the house of an alien young boy. And these are little people, I would say maybe about 4 inches tall. So when Arrietty, who's the young heroine, she stands on the kitchen counter, you have this feeling that she's at the edge of the Grand Canyon. And I think this movie captures those sorts of things in a way that BFG sometimes misses out on a little bit. Maybe it's just having to combine live action and CGI that makes that not quite as immersive as what we have here, traditional animation. There's also a hushed quality to this film that's really remarkable, especially when you compare it to a lot of the banging and clattering that goes on in so many of the kids' movies we see nowadays. I love this one moment where the movie just pauses. Arrietty has walked away from under a bush in the garden, and the camera holds on the foliage for a few seconds. Then a ladybug skitters out onto a leaf. That pauses for a moment, opens its wings, and just quietly zips away. And that's all we get. And sometimes we talk about in films character moments where there are things that aren't needed for the plot, but they may seem extraneous, but they build the inner world of that character. I think this kind of is a world-building moment that really adds up to the overall experience of The Secret World of Arrietty. There's also this soft focus to the animation that I love. It has a painterly impressionistic quality. I've described it before as, you know, with the movement, it's like this gentle breeze is blowing through a Monet canvas. And it's just a really lovely experience. If somehow the movie was so quiet that it slipped past you, really encourage listeners to catch up with The Secret World of Arrietty.
I've got to watch it. I've never seen it. I love that in both of these films that you're mentioning, there's something about the point of view of things that aren't adult height.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So the idea that the world looks different from a child's point of view or something even smaller than a child's point of view and that that's relatable to kids, I think is exciting to think about as a device that maybe is central to why some of these films resonate so much with kids and then stick with you, is that you're looking at things from a very different perspective.
I hadn't thought about that before, but the miniature POV is a stand-in for the kids' POV. A lot of kids' movies will place the camera right at a child's height. That's kind of a common device, but this is like one step further. What do you have at your number three?
Charlotte's Web, the 1973 animated version, which when I looked up who did the voicing in this, I realized that Debbie Reynolds is Charlotte, and I love Debbie Reynolds. And so that was exciting to me to realize. And really the scene that sticks out the most for me in this film is the song by Templeton, the rat, when he's careening through the county fair, I think it is.
Nell and rinds and bits, a hot dog's cookie crumbs and rock cotton candy melted ice cream, mustard dribblings, moldy goodies everywhere. Lots of popcorn, apple cores, banana peels and soggy sandwiches and gobs, a gorgeous scoop to gobble at the fair.
The voicing in that and the visuals of that, again, here we go. We got a rat's point of view of the world. And just, you know, the heart in that movie and the characters. I think Templeton was my favorite because, he felt so naughty and strange and different from everybody else in that world. And then to have, you know, this story that, again, was the first chapter book I read, get to read something first and then get to watch it on film, realizing that connection and getting to see the differences. I think I was very early on someone who wanted to watch the behind the scenes or read the screenplay. I would, you know, read books of scripts and plays and things like this. So
how'd they do it type stuff.
How'd they do it? Yeah. How'd they do it? And what was the magic behind this? And what were the pieces that were put together to make a new whole when it came to translating something from one medium to the next? I certainly didn't think about it in those sophisticated terms as a child, but I liked seeing different versions of the same story. And so this was the first chance I think I got to do that.
So watch this over the weekend. I'd seen it as a kid, of course, and hadn't seen it probably in, I don't know, 2 or 3 decades. So wanted to rewatch it. And I like Templeton. He does stand out in terms of characterization, and actually had someone on Letterboxd mention to me the same song that they thought was just fantastic. I can't say I liked all the music. It seemed to me sort of an intrusion on the E.B. White story. What overall struck me was the best stuff really came directly from White in this movie. Yeah. They use a lot of the narration and the language and the sense of, you know, experiencing mortality, not shying away from the idea of mortality, but experiencing it through this life in a barnyard. Mm-hmm. That was retained. So yeah, I did enjoy it overall for that. Jeffrey, though, the Gosling, just annoying.
Oh,
man.
Yeah,
I mean, and that was an addition, too. That's one of those where you're like, you didn't need Jeffrey the Gosling.
No.
And I would say the animation, too. It was Hanna-Barbera's, one of their feature-length efforts. And even as a kid, you know, the Jetsons and the Flintstones, there was something maybe coloring bookish about their animation style that never captured me as a kid. And that is carried over here. But I do really like the background landscapes in this animated feature of Charlotte's Web. They have more of like the pencil sketch quality that I think is it Garth Williams who did the original illustrations that echoes that in a way, especially in the opening credits. So yeah, there are some lovely, lovely touches in that film. I'm going to go to another 70s movie for me for my number 3, and it's The Black Stallion. This is a formative one for me. As a matter of fact, I think it's the only one on my list that I first saw as a child. 1979, this would have been. And it's adapted from the 1941 Walter Farley book about a boy who is shipwrecked on an island with an Arabian stallion. It's directed by Carroll Ballard, and he became known as something of an animal movie specialist. He went on to make Never Cry Wolf and Fly Away Home. And definitely the scenes with the horse and the boy are the best parts of the movie here. There's that section where the boy and the horse are on the island. And it's so magical when the boy first feeds. He's a scrawny kid, and he feeds this huge, majestic horse. And it's filmed at sunset. The cinematographer is Caleb Deschanel, and he just captures them in silhouette. So you've got these two figures, this shimmering sea in the background, and their tentative gestures make it into this really beautiful dance sequence almost. Now, the other parts of the movie I think are pretty strong, too. The shipwreck itself, which is at the very beginning, is just terrifying. I mean, it was probably one of my first encounters with movie drowning, which I think is just, you know, one of those experiences you have as a movie-going kid that you're like, I can't take this. You know, it feels claustrophobic.
Your chest gets tight.
Yeah, something that, you know, kids are told from swimming lessons on. You know of this as a possibility, and to have it sort of dramatized for you is just so terrifying at a young age. There's also the latter section of the movie where the horse and the boy are rescued and they're cared for by this aging jockey who's played by Mickey Rooney. That gets pretty emotional. You know, you don't hear much about The Black Stallion anymore, at least I don't, but I consider it an undersung classic. So I encourage people to check it out if they haven't ever seen it.
You're a thief. You're a big fat thief.
Nobody's a thief.
You are.
I said nobody's a thief. Who do you think you're calling a thief? This is my place. And I'm thinking that that's my horse.
No, he's mine.
Hold on, son. Now, wait a minute. You hold on there. What are you going to do here? What are you going to do?
I think I haven't watched it since I was a kid, so I got to go back and watch it, especially because Mickey Rooney. Come on.
Yeah,
you got to love some Mickey Rooney.
Yeah, and he's really wonderful in it, too. I mean, it's just balancing that line of schmaltziness or genuine emotion. I think he pulls it off. So that brings us to our number 2 children's book adaptation. What do you have at that slot, Tricia?
Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins.
1964, but whose childhood since then hasn't included watching that film? And it's so imprinted on me. I was thinking about, of the movies on this list, that there were some that stuck with me in sort of snapshot ways, but I think I could recount for you almost beat by beat what happens in Mary Poppins, and I think a lot of us can.
Yeah.
Because it was a movie that just from the music to the sort of magical elements of it that are interspersed in this realistic world, it was the first time I think I saw a movie that did that in the way that it happens, where just a couple of years ago, I remember walking by a chalk art contest where these really talented artists were drawing these scenes on the sidewalk. And I walked by, and of course, in my head, I thought, well, what if we just jumped inside?
Isn't that how it works?
Isn't that how it works?
Why do you always complicate things that are really quite simple? Give me your hand, please, Michael. Don't slouch. One, two...
Mary Poppins, you look beautiful.
Do you really think so?
Cross my heart, you do. Like the day I met you.
You look fine too, Bert.
Dick Van Dyke and Julie Andrews in this film, just stunning performances from top to bottom. And I think, you know, it almost feels trite to talk about how great this movie is to me because, duh, it's Mary Poppins. I looked up on IMDb because I was trying to remember the names of the characters who were what I would have called the maids in the household, who were so funny, this big, broad humor that they did. And they were called the domestics, which I thought was entertaining when I looked that up. The kids are, I think, striking that balance of a little cartoony, but fitting within the world and actually doing some acting with some heart also in this film.
And they're really on the side, too, so that you get small doses of them, which helps, I think.
And I think this is one of those movies that is for kids, but is also really for adults.
Mm.
You know, the father character in this film is someone who works an awful lot and, you know, tries to make time to bring a little bit of joy and wonder back into my life. I can relate with the banker a little bit. Okay. And I think a lot of us maybe can of thinking, yeah, what are we spending all our time doing here? And why aren't we having a little more magic in our days?
Okay. Well, that's interesting because it speaks to the one reservation I have about Mary Poppins. And really, who should have any reservations about Mary Poppins? I know. And who should have anything bad to say about Julie Andrews? But this is a through line with her in Mary Poppins and The Sound of Music. Bad dads. Really, really down on the dads. And, you know, some of that is obviously deserved. The critique you're talking about is one worth considering, not just for dads, obviously, but does speak to men. And I just think when I watch those now and rewatch them with my kids, I'm like, I'm not that bad. Come on, give me a break. But yeah, Mary Poppins is a wonderful film. My number two is a movie that, goodness knows, I'm going to get grief for bringing up, for having on this list, because I've talked enough about Wes Anderson lately, but it is Fantastic Mr. Fox. I know listeners, though, aren't sick of hearing about Anderson because they did vote for Fantastic Mr. Fox over Where the Wild Things Are in our poll about the best children's book adaptation of 2009, but I'm sticking with it. It's another Dahl adaptation, and rather than me giving Anderson more love, I'll share something from Wes Anderson connoisseur Matt Zoller cites. In his book, The Wes Anderson Collection, Seitz writes this: Fantastic Mr. Fox is an Andersonian primer, rethinking the director's style and themes in terms that everyone, kids included, can understand and enjoy. Liberally adapted by Anderson and Noah Baumbach from Roald Dahl's novel, it's a fable about the tension between responsibility and freedom, and a portrait of families in repose and turmoil. That bit about this being an Andersonian primer, that's certainly true for my family. It's the first Anderson film that my kids have seen and is a favorite in our house. So had to be on this list.
It's fair. It's got to be on the list. I think I almost put it on my list, but I had to talk about Hook. It was going to be there, but I wanted to go with some of the deep cuts that really, as a child, I think that was one of the things that I did a little more on my list was, what are the things that have stuck with me, stuck onto me since childhood? And the first one on my list is definitely the film that does that the most, and that's Willy Wonka.
This is your number one?
That's my number one.
The original, the first?
Yes.
Okay.
The Gene Wilder film, which I didn't realize, and then when I looked it up, Roald Dahl wrote the screenplay for this
version. I'd forgotten that. Yeah.
So seeing what he did to transform his own work, I think, was interesting here. It was scary, as all get out. That tunnel scene, I think we all remember. I think that the archetypes that were created in all of the kids that are going through the experience with Charlie are such a pervasive cultural jargon that we can use with each other. It's a shorthand, right, to be able to talk about things that happen in that film that I think of, you know, are you being a TV mic right now?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
don't be a Veruca Salt about this. You know, you can kind of...
That's all you need to say.
It's, yeah, people know what you mean when you say those things to them. And I think that the idea of what it means to be a family was beautiful in that film, to have the grandparents...
Multi-generational
family, and to see a, you know, working class kid see this world and at first be completely overtaken by all of the glitz and glamour of it, and then realizing that the things that are going to keep him sane and keep him safe are the things that he already had, was something that I think this film does really beautifully, is the idea that all the candy in the world doesn't make you happy. He's Willy Wonka's miserable, right? And it was also, I think, an interesting way to start to understand capitalism, if that can be a part of the film that stands out to me still. The idea of a corporate spy in your midst and the fact that this was a, you know, shining factory on the hill so near where this poverty was happening. There was a lot of things about class and family that come up in that film and in that storytelling that really resonated with me and stuck with me through, you know, also the Oompa Loompas, right? All these other things that we think of as fun and funny about that movie.
Sure.
There's a lot of darkness in that film.
Oh, yeah.
A lot.
Well, and that speaks to Dahl's involvement, maybe, because this is also an example of what I mentioned earlier, where he was never afraid to offend a kid's delicate sensibilities. And this is maybe the best example in all of Dahl's work of kids being recognized as brats.
Yeah.
Right? Like, kids could be brats. And you know it as a kid. You know other kids who are brats. You know when you're being a brat. And Dahl is kind of like, this is what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Daddy, I want a golden goose.
Here we go again.
All right, sweetheart. All right. Daddy will get you a golden goose as soon as we get home.
No, I want one of those.
Wonka, how much do you want for the golden goose?
They're not for sale.
Name your price.
She can't have one.
Who says I can't?
The man with the funny hat.
I want one. I want a golden goose. Gooses. Geeses. I want my geese to lay gold eggs for Easter.
So there's that honest element that I think kids respond to in his work when they see it. The kids know when they're being placated, you know, or condescended to. And Dahl never did that in his books. And this movie captures that. Plus Gene Wilder.
Oh, yeah.
Don't care how I want it now.
She was a bad egg.
Where's she gone?
Where all the other bad eggs go? Down the garbage chute.
Oh, the garbage chute. Where did it lead to?
To the furnace.
The furnace!
If only he were still doing work, maybe we wouldn't want that because it couldn't be as good as what he did do in the 70s. But I'm on record for being a defender and a fairly big fan of Tim Burton's version, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And I think Johnny Depp is doing some interesting things there, but there's no way it compares to what Wilder is doing here. The sense of menace and danger that he brings to it is just wonderfully, unsettlingly thrilling when you're a kid, and just a delight, even more of a delight when you're an adult, I think. All right, that brings me to my number one. And what could get me to vote against Wes Anderson in that best of 2009 poll? Well, only a movie that uses staggering landscapes, giant puppets, seamless computer effects, and elaborate sets to capture and, I'd say, push way further the fantastic vision of one of my favorite childhood picture books, Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. I had this movie on my list of the top five locations we wish we could visit in episode 542, trying to reclaim a little bit of childhood there, I think. It was also my number three movie of the film spotting era when we did that special show. So that's, of all the movies that have been out since 2005, I had this at number three. Clearly one of my personal favorites, directed by Spike Jonze, of course, from a script by Jonze and Dave Eggers. And I think this speaks to what I was just saying about Dahl, maybe. One of the things I like about it is the way, unlike most other children's films, which prefer, let's say, plucky orphans, sounds familiar, good-hearted wallflowers, or other sympathetic figures, here, Max, played by Max Reynolds, is really ferocious, right? He's a trouble. He's a bad kid in some ways.
And
some
not
people
in a
might
charming.
No, exactly.
And not in a charming Dennis the Menace-y kind of way.
That is it. He's scary. You watch him and you think, I don't want to babysit that kid. That's sort of my reaction. I mean, in this movie, he's wearing the ratty wolf suit. He's growling with a startling ferocity, chasing the family dog with a fork. And, you know, that's a detail that comes right from the book, but is so disturbing. You know, it's one thing to chase a dog, but when there's that kid chasing the dog with a fork, that's a different kid. And this is the kid we're going to be with and try to understand and learn about in this movie. And we do eventually learn that Max can be sweet. He has an astonishing imagination, right? But the distinctive point here is that he's also savage. And I think this becomes especially clear when he runs away from home and then he encounters these wild things in his imagination. They're these 12-foot-tall amalgamations of real animals, mythical figures. They're envisioned so perfectly, and the vocal work is so beautiful in this movie. James Gandolfini primarily providing one of the voices here.
See?
This guy gets it.
Hey, weird little thing. I like the way you destroy stuff. Good technique. There's a spark to your work that can't be taught.
Thanks.
All right, you see that one over there? You get that one, I'll get this one. So you can do it faster, okay?
Okay.
Things get even weirder in the movie than they do in the book, and I'm okay with that. After all, I mean, this is what you get when you allow for interpretation. You get something like that howling tribal soundtrack from Karen O of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. That wasn't in the book, but I'm so glad it's in the movie because that's just perfect as well. So I think this is a film. A couple of the listeners who left comments in our poll results said that this is a movie better appreciated by adults who have lived through childhood. And I think maybe that's because it captures some of the more difficult qualities of kids, their wildness, but also their fearfulness, their uncertainty, their cruelty. We like to think of childhood as this time of innocence and simplicity, but, you know, an honest trip down memory lane reveals that we weren't always like that. And there's something really endearing about going through that honest experience again through this film. So Where the Wild Things Are, that is my number one. Those are our top five children's book adaptations. I had an honorable mentions list of probably 20 titles long, Tricia, so I don't know if we have time to get to all of those. Are there a couple that were just about to jump onto your list, but you set aside, you mentioned, you thought about Fantastic Mr. Fox? But
yeah, there were a few that were on your list that in an alternate universe could have definitely been on mine, but I tried to veer away from those. And I think that one of the areas that I steered clear of, even though I do think of these as some of my favorite movies for different ways, were a lot of the Disney films that, sure, yeah, they were things that were books way before, but like you said, we think of more as movies than as books. So, you know, thinking about even something like The Lion King, Hamlet isn't so much a children's book, so that didn't make the list.
Right.
But there were things like that I really love. And
like, was Dumbo a children's book? I'm thinking it had to be, but I don't know.
Very possibly, okay. But yeah, a lot of the Disney stories, right, if not from distinct books, they're ripped from stories that are old enough that they were public domain by the time Disney wanted use them in some way. I think that the musical version, a lot of musicals, that's just the way it's going to be with me. The musical version of Cinderella is one that I think of very fondly, too. And I think the iterations of Cinderella over time, that story's been done so many times in so many ways. The Brandy Cinderella is so important to so many people because it was the first African-American princess they saw in one of those stories. So I think there's some stories like that that not one single iteration of them as an adaptation stands out on the list, but Cinderella would be one that keeps getting reinvented and rewritten in different ways for different generations. And I think that that's important to keep taking those classic stories and twisting them.
Sure, sure. A few I want to mention here because they were very close. You had my number six, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. That is one that I do love. I'm a huge fan of Shrek. I know, especially with the 16 sequels or whatever, it's kind of diminishing returns on those. But I thought the original was not only funny and the first to kind of deconstruct all of those Disney movies, but also had some interesting things to say about what a princess needs to look like. And maybe we're getting a little used to those ideas being subverted by now, but when the original Shrek came out, that was pretty smart. The Iron Giant, based on a book, one of my favorites. Coraline, we mentioned earlier in the show. And Babe, the movie from George Miller, was first a children's book, one of my absolute favorite kids' movies. So that easily could have been on my list. Those are our top five children's book adaptations. Send us your picks to feedback@filmspotting.net. And if you're listening to the podcast edition of this show, stick around for a little bit. Tricia and I are going to chat about some of our favorite children's literature as literature.
Leave Film Spotting a voicemail at 312-264-0744. And you may hear it featured on an upcoming show. Find Film Spotting on Facebook and on Twitter. Adam is at Film Spotting. Josh is at Larson on Film.
And Tricia, you're on Twitter. Remind me again, what's your handle there?
At Nerdette Podcast.
All right. And we mentioned Nerdette going to be going on a little bit of a break here, a summer break, but plenty of episodes in the can for people who are unfamiliar with the show to check out. We will link to Nerdette in the notes for this week's show. You can find that at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, 11 years of reviews, marathons, interviews, and top fives. Those are in our show archives. In case you want to hear the original reviews of Fantastic Mr. Fox or Where the Wild Things Are, or even Tim Burton's Wonka adaptation. While you're there, be sure to vote in the current Film Spotting poll. We're asking you to pick the best film of the year so far. And if you haven't already, we encourage you to check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, Film Spotting SVU, and The Next Picture Show. Very excited. It's new episode week for Next Picture Show. They and SVU are on alternating week schedules. So this week we get Next Picture Show. They're looking at Finding Dory and Memento. Intriguing pairing there. You can find both of those shows in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Opening in wide release this week is The BFG, which Trisha and I both recommend. Also, The Legend of Tarzan, another swing at this tale with Alexander Skarsgård, Margot Robbie, Christoph Waltz, and Samuel L. Jackson. Also in wide release is The Purge, Election Year. In limited release, Swiss Army Man, that's with Paul Dano as Robinson Crusoe and Daniel Radcliffe as his loyal farting corpse Friday. Next week, Adam's going to be back. I'm going to be on a little bit of a break. Adam's co-host for that show will be Seattle-based film writer Melissa Taminga. Looking forward to hearing what she has to say. They're going to review Swiss Army Man along with a top five to be determined. I'm assuming it's probably going to involve flatulence.
Which this movie, The BFG, had no shortage of.
We didn't get into that, did we?
we're kind of letting it off the hook. Fizz
Whopper?
Fizz popping,
that's what it is.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Music this week from Cat's Eyes from their new album, Treasure House.
Cat's Eyes, also the composers of the music for last year's Duke of Burgundy.
More information at catseyes.tv. For Film Spotting, I'm Trisha Bobita.
And I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
So BFG, favorite book of yours as a kid, or were there other ones?
I loved that book. Okay. There are certain moments in it that visually stuck in my mind that I was looking forward to in the movie for sure. But I remember my first chapter book that I read was Charlotte's Web when I was six.
It's so good.
And I remember it being kind of a big book. I think the version of it we had was a hardcover, so it felt hefty to walk around the house with it. I felt important.
Felt real,
reading such
right?
a big book. And I was also very much a Boxcar Children reader. Cardboard boxcar that you put the books in, the original
That's
19.
Right. Yeah. I didn't read those myself, but my kids devoured those.
And there's hundreds of them now.
Yes. It's kind of crazy. Yeah. I remember picture books being, you know, the first ones that are sticking in my mind where I can picture myself sitting down, paging through them, having them read to me, of course, but then later looking through them yourself. And Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah.
Was a foundational one for me. Mm-hmm. Just so creepy and thrilling to watch that kid be so bad.
Yeah, it was. It was like, is this okay? Is this allowed?
Yeah. And Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree. Did you ever read that one?
Oh, yeah.
Man, was that sad. Yeah. I remember as a kid, you know, when that would come to the end, I think I'd pour all of my sadness from whatever was going on in my life, like into that story. And then I would just close it and be like,
yeah,
that was very sad. I'm going to move on now.
I think fiction teaches us to do that, even really young. It teaches you how to be sad.
Yeah. That story does it. Absolutely. Yeah. And I love the drawings there. So how about picture books? Do you remember picture books?
I'm trying to think of which ones I would remember from being that young. There were definitely a lot of them around the house. My house was full of books all the time.
Nice.
And so I think very early on, I reached sort of above my shelf, so to speak, for the chapter books. But I mean, I spent a lot of time babysitting and nannying all through growing up. And so some of those I remember reading over and over again to kids.
Sure.
So Rainbow Fish obviously sticks in my mind as one.
Don't know that one.
So it's a fish who has sort of sparkly scales and not everybody else does. And then he gives them away one by one.
Okay.
And so it's a story about, you know, visible differences not needing to be so important and sharing and all that. And of course, Dr. Seuss. Those are the ones when I think back, Green Eggs and Ham, the first ones that I think I was trying to read on my own.
Yeah.
You know, sitting alone and going like, okay, I know this story. I know the rhythm of it. It feels like reading, even though you're kind of just memorizing it.
Yeah. And a lot of Dr. Seuss too is, I feel similar to Where the Wild Things Are. There's a thrilling, dangerous chaos to them.
Yeah.
Right. And you feel a little bit like you're getting away with something reading those. Like maybe the adults don't know how wild things are in this book. Right. But I love it. And Dr. Seuss is great for that.
Yeah. And parents are often missing from those. Right. The Cat
Their
in the Hat
arms.
Comes over.
I can picture like parents' arms reaching from off the page. Sometimes you'll see that. But you're right. It's a little bit like Peanuts. Otherwise, we're completely in a kid's world.
Yeah, exactly.